U.S. sanctions severely impact human rights. That is a grim assessment by a top U.N. human rights official who has slammed the United States for its brutal sanctions regime against the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine her remarks, not only about the brutal sanctions on Iran, but also its impacts on other countries and why it rarely achieves U.S. objectives, if at all.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are illegal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling the for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the UN Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Our guest, Daniel Kovalik, he's a university lecturer and author of The Plot to Attack Iran, who joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Daniel Kovalik, welcome. We have this special rapporteur from the UN who I'm going to read the title, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Negative Impact of Unilateral Coercive Measures on the Enjoyment of Human Rights. Now, she's been in Iran from May 7th to the 18th, today being the 18th, and it's the first by a UN Special Rapporteur in this type of visit. And she has concluded, amongst many things, decades of sanctions have wholly affected Iranian people's lives and have particularly hit low-income section of society. On this one finding that she announced, what is your reaction?
Well, I mean, it makes sense. I believe it. I think we've known this for a long time, those of us who've been condemning sanctions as both illegal and immoral, because, in fact, they're intended to hurt people, and they do hurt the most vulnerable. And there have been studies over the years in countries, for example, like North Korea, which have shown that these types of sanctions disproportionately hurt women and children. And again, we've known that for years, and we've known that in Venezuela. There have been reports on Venezuela as well. So this is not a surprise to me.
When you take a look at another statement she made, and I'm wondering if this would make any difference, she has said the unilateral coercive measures, as she called it, the UCM against Iran, and she works under a mandate from the UN Human Rights Council. She's called on Washington to abandon, according to what she said, its hard-nosed policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Will Washington do that or listen?
Well, I'm not certain. There was some good news this week. Biden announced that he is going to end the maximum pressure campaign against Venezuela, and he has rolled back some sanctions, extra sanctions that Trump had imposed on Cuba. So maybe there's a chance that someone in the U.S. will listen. This report, in truth, is well-timed. Maybe there's someone in the White House at the moment who will listen to this. I certainly hope so.
When it comes to the issue of sanctions themselves, of course, she has raised the legality of it, something which many have said, obviously, is illegal. And she said the U.S. continues to illegally ban trade and investment, for example, in Iran, forcing foreign companies economically for the country to take a hit by them leaving in fear of sanctions. And also the fact that obviously these foreign companies cannot conduct financial activities. The legality of the sanctions is something that could fall under the UN, or can it not, in terms of a mandate that's illegal, the illegality of it, and then for the UN therefore do something about it.
Yeah, well, the UN has ruled that these types of sanctions are illegal, especially to the extent they have extraterritorial application, which these do. What does that mean? It's when the U.S., for example, and the U.S. uses these types of sanctions the most, the U.S. not only says, okay, we're going to sanction Iran by not trading with Iran, for example, right? But what they do, they go well beyond that. They impose pressure and sanctions on third countries who want to do business with Iran, right? And that, the U.N. has said, is clearly illegal. Only the Security Council can authorize that those types of sanctions. And they have not done so in this case. So they're clearly illegal.
What about the fact that you have sanctions as a whole in terms of the effectiveness? Based on our accounts, we have more than 40 economic sanctions placed on 36 countries that the U.S. has exercised since 1993. But it is said that the efficiency rate of sanctions is roughly maybe between 23% to 25% at best, and it's not the kind of success rate that the U.S. actually is looking for, and it doesn't obtain the desired results that the U.S. is looking for. So why does the U.S. go down a road where basically it's a failed policy in terms of how it uses it?
Well, again, what are the goals of these sanctions? The goals tend to be regime change. They want to change the government in power. To the extent that's the goal, it almost never succeeds. In fact, you know, the U.S.'s own studies show that, right? But what it is effective in doing is undermining the country's economies, right? And so what does that do for the U.S.? I mean, that is at least a secondary goal of the U.S. If they can't destroy the government or change the government, they're going to cripple the society, right? And so it just becomes purely punitive. And that is a secondary goal. And that is the type of sanction they impose very, frequently on these countries. Again, the goal seemingly only to be to punish the people for choosing the wrong government. And that sends a message to other countries. You better not choose the wrong government, right? So that it has a certain effectiveness in that way. It's a cruel goal, but that is, in fact, the goal.
You mentioned Venezuela. Maybe it's good to do a flashback here back to the year 2019. I don't know if you remember, there was a report that came out, and this is right before COVID, actually, that U.S. sanctions on Venezuela is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, based on a report that came out. And this was, of course, not the beginning, but it was almost in the middle of the U.S. push for wanting Maduro out and wanting the other opposition leader to come into power. But then, as you mentioned, the U.S. has announced that it's rolling back some of the sanctions on Venezuela, and you mentioned Cuba also. But when it has given the green light, it's for the sanctions to roll back. But isn't that for its own benefit, because it's looking for oil? As it has said, U.S. and European oil companies can restart their operations. So it's for U.S.'s benefit. It's not really looking out for Venezuelans.
No, well, again, that's never the intention. You know, the U.S. may claim it cares about people in Venezuela or Iran or Cuba or Nicaragua, but that's not true. That's never true. As you say, these things are done according to the U.S.'s own shifting interest at any given time. And as you say, at the moment, with the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia, now the U.S. finds itself in a world where oil and gas are becoming more scarce, prices are going up, so now they're looking for other sources, including from Venezuela and including from Iran. And that is motivating, as you say, fairly, the U.S. to lift some sanctions on Venezuela with the hope that Venezuela that they can get oil again from Venezuela. And we know that they want oil from Iran, and maybe that will motivate the U.S. to lift some sanctions on Iran. But you're right. It's all for self-serving purposes. And you mentioned the study that was done by CEPR, which is a think tank in the United States. And they, according to their study, which is probably the most detailed of its kind, they estimated in 1 year alone 40,000 Venezuelans died due to U.S. sanctions. So that's an staggering number of people, given that those sanctions have continued for a number of years. So you add it up, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of deaths. And I'm sure that you could find the same numbers in Iran.
Well, one of the open admissions could not be any clearly spelled out when it came from the former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I don't know if you remember that. He said that if Iranian officials must listen to Washington if they want their people to eat. That was a pretty profoundly shocking statement coming from a U.S. official. It's an open threat to starve the Iranian nation, which at that point the former foreign minister of Iran said is a crime against humanity and a desperate attempt to impose U.S. whims on Iran. What's your reaction to a statement coming out from a former U.S. official at this point?
No, it's also an admission of a war crime is what it is. I mean, even during war, you can't deny people food. And we're not even at war with Iran, right? So, I mean, this it is a crime against humanity. It is a war crime. And there's been other quotes like that from, you know, various secretaries of state and U.S. presidents, going back, well, I can remember to Chile and Allende in the 70s, where Nixon said we would make the economy scream, right? And various presidents have talked about increasing the suffering on other peoples, like in Venezuela. That the statements have been similar. Statements have been made about people if they want lights on and food in Venezuela, they have to get rid of their government, etc. No, this is talk of war criminals, right? These are people who should be in The Hague at this point if you had a real justice system.
Another surprising outcome that comes from the U.S. sanctions, of which the government in a sense dismisses it, even though they do admit, is the economic cost that it comes, aside from the countries it sanctions, but for the U.S. itself. And one study had actually put that figure at around $1 billion annually. And it went back to the year, I think it was 2001. Well, if you count all the years up to now, you know, we're talking about $20 or $21 billion. I mean, that's quite a bit of money, money that the U.S., I'm sure, or any country can use. So the economic sanctions are not just losses for other countries that the U.S. imposes. Do you think that that's a worthy gamble the U.S. takes when you put that next to the fact that the efficiency rate is roughly about 25% at best?
Well, of course not. And it shows, again, it shows that the U.S. government even doesn't care about its own people, right? I mean, let's be honest here. The U.S. now, for example, these sanctions against Russia has created an inflationary period, is causing food prices to rise in the U.S. and food shortages. In fact, Biden at the outset of those sanctions warned there would be food shortages in the U.S. We now have a baby formula shortage in the U.S. So these sanctions are done knowing even that the American people are going to suffer. None of these things benefit any people, not in the targeted countries, not in the U.S. It just shows a total disregard for human life, whether it be foreign life or American life. And yeah, I mean, it's something that needs to be pushed back against.
And taking the vantage point from Iran, we are still obviously experiencing sanctions, but really the ones that are suffering the most, even if you want to put aside the types of hardships that people are having for their basic needs, such as food staples, are the ones that are in dire need of medical aid. That's not happening because, for starters, you have the financial system, payment system, which is locked. And even humanitarian organizations can't transfer money into Iran for on humanitarian grounds. Shouldn't there be anything that could stop the U.S. from this aspect of it, so at least medical equipment or supplies or aid can come into the country?
Yeah, well, there's numerous legal instruments that require countries who are engaged in, you know, even wars on other countries to make sure the food and medicine gets in. It's called the Geneva Conventions, right? The Hague Convention of 1907. I mean, for over a century, the Community of Nations has recognized that countries cannot deny other countries food and medicine. Yeah, I mean, even this could be an issue for the International Criminal Court. If you had a legal system, an international legal system that was working, yes, something would be done to make sure that people in Iran were getting medicine and food. And it is it's shocking that that is not happening.
And then final question to you. The sanctions regime, one of the things that it does do is that it turns people against the U.S., the sanctioned country. And that could pose a national security threat for the U.S. Does the U.S. take that into account when it imposes sanctions, especially severe sanctions, on countries that it has applied so far?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S. government doesn't seem to judge national security in the way most rational people do. I mean, most rational people view national security as the security of people like me and my fellow citizens. But the U.S. doesn't care about that, right? It's not about national security in that sense. It's about domination, economic, political, military domination. And to that extent, the sanctions fit into that goal perfectly, even though it compromises the real security, again, of the U.S.'s own citizens that the U.S. government seems not to care about.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Daniel Kovalik, university lecturer and author of The Plot to Attack Iran from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thank you for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takvai, it's goodbye until next time.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam. السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam. In so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements, we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: إن المرء إذا نام فإن روح الحيوان باقية في البدن، والذي يخرج منه روح العقل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, when man sleeps, the animal spirit within him remains with his body, and that which leaves it is the rational spirit.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, of course we find that His Eminence spoke about something very unique. He spoke about a conversation and a dialogue that one must have with the Almighty Allah. And so, in a conversation with one of his companions, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam spoke to his companion and told him how one should address the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, when it comes to the Almighty Allah, who better to turn towards when we want to find out how exactly should we address the Creator of all of creation? And so Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam taught this one dua to his companion, and in this dua we find a very beautiful statement. Imam al-Kadhim, addressing the Almighty Allah, says, "You are the object of requests, and to you is the flight." And so, dear friends, in our lives where we really try to find a safe haven to turn towards, and we really try to find somewhere where we can flee and find refuge. Here, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam teaches us in this conversation and in this dialogue, in this form of a dua, that it is towards Allah that is the flight. And just as any bird flies towards safe haven and refuge, and ultimately flies towards its home, there where it feels safe, for us, that safe haven and that refuge and that home where we can find complete safety is the Almighty Allah. And also we learn that it is Allah who is the ultimate object of our desires. It is Allah who is the ultimate goal and the ultimate mission and the ultimate purpose of our desires and our yearning. And it is when we put these two things together, the first, that the Almighty Allah is the object of our desires, and two, it is the Almighty Allah to whom we fly towards, will we really begin to understand the beauty that is Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij. This is the door or the gate through which your prayers will be accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your hajat, hawaij, your hajat will be responded to by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if you take your hajat through this gate. And this is not only limited to the Shias. You know, we have a historian who lived in the 4th century by the name of Al-Khatib al-Baghdadi. And one of his famous books, actually, he's from Baghdad itself. And in his book, Tariq Baghdad, in the very first volume, he talks about the 7th Imam and he quotes a statement from Abu Ali al-Khilal, a Sunni Hanbali scholar. And this is, you know, before the 4th century. And he says that this Hanbali scholar used to say, "Ma hammani amrun faqasadtu qabra Musa bin Ja'far fatawassaltu bihi." He says, whenever I had issues and problems, I used to go to the grave of Musa bin Ja'far fatawassaltu bihi. And I used to seek tawassul, intercession through him. Illa wa sahhala Allahu ta'ala li ma uhibbu. And whenever this happened, when I went through him, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala facilitated my hajat and my desires.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even... saving, now you've got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up, petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit to until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing one in two people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Said Pourza, London.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking a opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened. I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die, while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
Final results of Lebanon's parliamentary elections are out, with Hezbollah and its allies securing at least half of the seats in the legislative body. The Minister of Interior stressed that the election process was complex and difficult, but free and fair.
With regards to the percentage of voters and the population of Lebanon and the circumstances surrounding the elections, it was a successful election and can be considered a significant achievement. The incidents which took place are marginal and very few in relation to the number of districts and polling stations and ballot boxes, which were around 6,900. These elections were fair and credible.
Despite the political silence during the declaration of the results, analysts believe commotion is yet to come.
Despite of the results, which are almost a tie, I believe that the other camp will keep trying to promote this agenda of disarming Hezbollah. And of course, on the other hand, Hezbollah will try to fail their plans. But while doing so, the Americans and their allies in Lebanon will further deteriorate the economic situation as to blame Hezbollah.
Newcomers to the parliament include members of civil society, which are reportedly sponsored by the United States. The Lebanese forces and its allies also secured a relatively large bloc and could step up their anti-resistance rhetoric.
They were sponsored by the United States, and part of the sponsorship is to promote this agenda, which is to call for disarming Hezbollah as a mean to isolate Lebanon from the Arab-Israeli struggle and facilitate the deal of the century to pass.
The new parliament is set to meet within 15 days to elect its executive council and a speaker of the parliament. In the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections, many fear that the polarization reflected in the campaigns preceding the elections could be manifested in parliament, leading to a political paralysis. Will the foes succeed in putting aside controversial issues and work together towards financial recovery? Or are there foreign interests that require that a war of attrition against the resistance continues? Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery.
While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN-brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
Today, the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and the large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid the critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The
The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who want it to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
The Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement, aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it. But to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done, and so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Islam's victory over joint Arab-Israelite army. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and today, the 17th of Shawwal is the anniversary of a very important event in the history of Islam and humanity that teaches us that the plots of satanic elements, whether at present or in the future, will continue to fail, since it is God Almighty who has guaranteed the triumph of the righteous, no matter what great armies, strategic alliances, and sophisticated weapons the wayward could muster. It is the day the crucial Battle of Khandaq, or Ditch, also known as Battle of Ahzab, or Confederates, since the Arabs and Israelites had ganged up together against Islam, ended on a victorious note for Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us for a special feature. Allah sent back the faithless in the rage, without their attaining any advantage. And Allah spared the faithful of fighting, and Allah is all-strong, almighty. This is how the Almighty Creator sums up in Ayah 25 of Surah Ahzab the defeat and retreat of a formidable, 10,000-strong joint Arab-Israeli army that had marched upon Medina to kill the Prophet with the help of the hypocrites amongst the Muslims and to obliterate Islam. Following the failure of the first ever armed encounter imposed upon the Prophet by the infidels of Mecca at Badr in 2 AH, the Arabs and the Israelites had been fuming with rage and devising plans to uproot Islam. Abu Sufyan, the archenemy of Islam, held talks with the Arabicized Jew Ka'b al-Ashraf, and the two, after showing reciprocal respect for each other's dubious creeds, pledged to muster a formidable joint force against the Sea Love Messengers. God Almighty has pointed to this conspiracy in Ayah 53 of Surah Nisa. Have you not regarded those who were given a share of the book, believing in the idol and the evil spirit, and saying of the pagans, these are better guided on the way than those who have faith in Islam? With the mysterious death of Ka'b, the joint plot did not materialize, and the Umayyad infidel Abu Sufyan, in his thirst for avenging the defeat at Badr, marched upon Medina in 4 AH, but failed to achieve his goal. Thanks to the swordsmanship of Imam Ali, peace upon him, that saved the Prophet and Islam in the Battle of Uhud. The next year, in 5 AH, Abu Sufyan assembled warriors from as many Arab tribes as he could, and in league with the Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir and Banu Quraizah, the latter having breached their pledge of neutrality to the Prophet, descended upon Medina with a force of 10,000 that boasted in the ranks the warlord Amr ibn Abduwad, who was a veritable giant known for his brute strength. Having been informed of the Arab-Israeli plot against Islam, the Prophet prepared the defenses of Medina, whose natural fortifications were rocky heights and thick palm groves, and, on the suggestion of his Iranian companion, Salman Farsi, dug a deep trench on the strip of the city that was vulnerable to enemy attack. While digging the ditch that involved the removing of huge boulders, which emitted sparks when struck by pickaxes, the Prophet gave tidings of the liberation of Syria, Iran, and Yemen by the Muslims in the future, at which the hypocrites amongst his companions expressed disbelief and hoped that this battle would result in the end of Islam. When the Confederate army arrived, it found its entry blocked by the newly dug ditch. For 15 days, the joint Arab-Israelite forces maneuvered, often shooting arrows at the Muslim defenders on the other side, but couldn't find a way to enter the city. With patience stretched thin, on the 17th of Shawwal, Amr ibn Abduwad, along with two other horsemen, found the narrowest point of the ditch and managed to spare their horses for a giant leap to the other side. Amr hurled a spear at the Prophet's tent and challenged the Muslims to single combat, at which most of the newly converted Muslims quaked with fear, while the hypocrites amongst them devised plans to seize the Prophet and hand him over to the enemy. The Prophet of Peace, in order to impart an immortal lesson to mankind that anyone who dares to disagree